This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. The new year doesn't require a new you, maybe just a less burdened you. Therapy can help more easily identify what weighs you down and holds you back by offering an unbiased perspective to better understand your relationships, motivations, and emotions. This past year was full of a lot of ups and downs and uncertainties for me, and those are by no means done. But being able to talk about it and get some outside perspective on what I'm experiencing is incredibly helpful and makes everything at least more comfortable, if not okay. With BetterHelp, they do the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals instead of searching for a therapist online. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment means they typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 157, The Seleucid Civil War. Right at the top today, just a reminder that I will be presenting on February 28th, 2026, as one of the keynote speakers at Intelligent Speech Online. I am joined by Matt Mitrovich, the alternate historian, and Rob and Jamie from Totalis Rankium as this year's keynote speakers. We also have a long lineup of additional speakers coming this year, and you can go to intelligentspeechonline.com to get your early bird tickets for the price of $20 before they go up at the beginning of next year, and you can get an additional 10% off when you use my promo code PERSIA. Easy enough to remember. IntelligentSpeechOnline.com, early bird tickets on sale right now. Promo code PERSIA for an additional 10% off. I will be presenting, then doing a Q&A. The theme is on companions and rivalries. We hope to see you there. On to the podcast. Last time we covered the Third Syrian War, which is also at least partially called the Laodicean War. After Antiochus II died, the Seleucid Empire was primed for conflict. Queen Laodice and her adult sons with the late King Antiochus were there when the king passed, and they were surrounded by Laodice's brothers, uncles, and cousins in Anatolia, while Queen Berenice was with her own infant son Antiochus in the Seleucis, a district of Syria surrounding the capitals of Seleucia and Antioch. Berenice and her son were killed by pro-Laodice assassins. Ptolemy III arrived in person under diplomatic pretenses, but the situation quickly escalated to open warfare as Ptolemaic forces seized control of Syria almost uncontested and proceeded to invade Babylon, potentially sending emissaries to assert their authority as far east as Susiana. However, Ptolemy was forced to return to Egypt when bread riots turned into outright rebellion. that gave the recently proclaimed King Seleucus II the opportunity to rally his forces and retake that conquered land. Not only that, but he began pushing Ptolemaic forces back in Damascus and Phoenicia. Despite the early setbacks, Seleucus was winning, but he needed more manpower to hold the offensive. He had earned the title Callinicus, the beautifully triumphant, and he wanted to hold that. So naturally it fell apart. The king's younger brother, Antiochus Hyrax, had been left with their mother and uncles to manage Anatolia as a viceroy, not unlike Cyrus the Younger on behalf of his father and brother generations earlier. And much like Cyrus, the queen mother favored her younger son. We don't know who planted the seeds of revolt. Laodike, Antiochus himself, one of their relatives. What we do know is that Hyrax claimed the throne for himself and refused his brother's call for aid with maternal support. Seleucus was forced to abandon the campaign in Syria, turn his army around, and march north to confront Antiochus. To secure his position in Anatolia, Antiochus finalized a marriage to the princess of Pontus almost as soon as his brother marched to war, in exchange for King Mithridates II marrying their sister, another Laodike. Meanwhile, the father and son duo of Ariarmenes and Ariarathes in Cappadocia saw which way the wind was blowing in their corner of the world, with most of Ariarathes' Seleucid in-laws to their west and the Pontic kingdom to their north siding with Antiochus. They were joined here by Arsames I of Armenia, who wasn't about to be a proxy for the other side when both of his immediate western neighbors backed Antiochus. Further needing to bolster his armies with experienced warriors and counteract the veteran fighting force that Seleucus now commanded in Syria, Hyrax poured money into the mercenary armies of Galatia to fill his ranks in the field. He was all but uncontested in Anatolia now, but his core of local support still came from Alexander, a royal uncle and currently the satrap of Lydia. So just like Cyrus the Younger again, Antiochus Hyrax made his capital at Sardis. Unlike Cyrus, though, Antiochus took a lesson from that Persian history and would force his brother to march against him rather than trying to go to the capital district himself. Now, for all my comparisons to Cyrus the Younger, because these situations are pretty similar politically, the Achaemenid War of the Brothers is all but unique in antiquity, especially pre-Roman antiquity. For those events, I could be painstakingly detailed. We had two eyewitnesses, one on either side, and Xenophon even documented the whole march to the ultimate confrontation. Not only do we not have a Xenophon, or even a Theseus, for the Seleucid Civil War in the mid-3rd century, we don't have any contemporary sources to speak of. For that matter, we barely have sources, period. The entire conflict is known primarily through brief references in ancient chronicles, just briefly listing and describing the events, rather than proper histories. Case in point, we don't have a single source to explain what happened for the first several years after Seleucus Callinicus withdrew from Phoenicia in 242. For all we know, he withdrew back to Antioch and just sat around trying to negotiate with his brother for almost half a decade. I don't think that's what happened, but it seems likely that there were significant stretches of downtime for negotiations. The first conflict we can sort of guess at in this fraternal war came at Sardis. Justin mentions that Seleucus besieged the city, but he also places that in the context of trying to evict Ptolemy from Anatolia. Ptolemy never took Sardis. It was Seleucus's acting capital while Antioch was under Egyptian occupation. If the Ptolemies had taken Sardis, the Third Syrian War would have effectively ended in wholesale Seleucid defeat. The later chronicler Eusebius is probably correct, placing that siege in the context of the Fraternal War. And just to get to Sardis, we should assume that there were some kind of skirmishes or even a smaller battle between Antioch and Lydia for Seleucus's forces to even get there, but none of that is documented. Whether Antiochus Hyrax was actually in Sardis at the time or not, we don't know. It was the regional capital, but Laodike and her family had many strongholds across the region. And in the early stages of the war, Antiochus's personal attention would have been demanded in securing their eastern alliances. However, the rebellious younger brother's most important ally ruled from Sardis. That was Uncle Alexander, son of Achaeus and grandson of the original Seleucus. Initially, Seleucus's army and Alexander's faced off in a pitched field battle, and the veteran host that had just finished fighting in Syria routed Alexander's local levies and mercenaries. They fled back to Sardis, where Alexander beat back his least favorite nephew's assault on the ancient Lydian city early in the war, and Seleucus had to withdraw. Seleucus may also have tried to retake Ephesus from the Ptolemies around this time with little success. Part of me wonders if he may have left his siege engines in the south, hoping to return to Syria quickly after dealing with his brother. If that was the original plan, it backfired spectacularly. It would also explain why he struggled to conquer any cities when he first arrived in Anatolia. Another potential skirmish came indirectly from King Zeilus of Bithynia. Always the petty kingdom of Anatolia that was most at odds with the Seleucids in general, it's not clear whether Zeilus sided with Seleucus, probably hoping that it would help him in any regional conflicts when his neighbors chose Antiochus, or if Bithynia was nominally neutral and just saw an opportunity to seize Seleucid territory while the royal brothers were distracted by one another. Either way, Antiochus joined his own army on a march across inland Anatolia, forcing the cities and settlements there to pay tribute to him, both as a way to legitimize his rule and get the money needed to fund this war. As Antiochus approached Bithynia, Zeilus attacked, was defeated, and fled back to Nicomedia to brace for a possible invasion by the younger Seleucid king. That invasion never came. Instead, sometime between 239 and 237, Seleucus Callinicus and his army, apparently working from a base in Caria, marched east across the southern edge of Anatolia and cut north to intercept the rebel forces somewhere in Galatia. The two armies finally met near the Gallic capital of Ancyra, coincidentally also the modern Turkish capital. This was the climactic battle of the war, or at least this stage of the war. And we know very little about it other than that happened, and the outcome. If I had to guess, based on all of the various ancient sources that reference participants in this battle, Antiochus and his allies lured Seleucus into a trap. That, or Seleucus, was attempting to intercept Antiochus's army as it marched east before they could link with their Galatian, Pontic, Cappadocian, and possibly Armenian allies. Despite any superior original plans, Seleucus wound up in the middle of Galatia, facing an army led by his brother and Mithridates II, backed by local Galatian armies, as well as forces from their other allies. It was a slaughter. According to some accounts, as many as 20,000 Seleucid loyalist soldiers were killed or captured by Antiochus, who suffered minimal casualties. Seleucus himself went missing in the aftermath of this battle. Initially, the king was presumed dead. Antiochus seized the opportunity, likely genuinely mourning the loss of a brother and seeing the political strength of publicly acting that way. He ordered cities across Anatolia to hold elaborate funeral celebrations and dress in mourning clothes for weeks after his victory at Ancyra. The mourning celebration was short-lived. Seleucus had escaped with a few of his personal retainers and traveled in disguise back to his base camp in Caria. Only when he returned to friendly territory did the king reveal himself and announce that news of his demise had been greatly exaggerated. Seleucus' wife, Queen Laodike II, probably wasn't with him. She had just recently given birth to their second son, a little boy uncomfortably named Antiochus. Likewise, even though he was now a young adult, their elder son, Alexander, appears to have stayed in Antioch, presumably fulfilling his father's royal duties as heir to the throne. However, one member of the king's household was captured at Ancyra, a concubine named Mista. She was caught up when the baggage train was sacked by Hyrax's forces and mistaken for a common camp follower to be sold into slavery. Sometime after Seleucus revealed himself, Mista was sold to a Rhodian slave trader who she was able to explain herself to. The island of Rhodes, not wanting to anger a king, got her back to Antioch right away. Alive or not, Seleucus' army had been all but destroyed at Ancyra, and Seleucus' remaining forces quietly withdrew back across the Taurus Mountains to the relative safety of Antioch. From there, Seleucus the beautifully triumphant sued for peace, at least temporarily allowing his brother to set up shop as an independent king in Anatolia, while Seleucus turned his attention eastward to try and hold what little remained of his empire together. Knowing multiple languages can open new doors, whether that's making travel easier, creating new career opportunities, or just a desire to learn. Language learning is its own gate of all nations. Rosetta Stone makes it easier and more immersive than ever. They provide the leading language learning program for desktop and mobile to fully immerse you in your chosen language with a more natural and effective learning experience. I've mentioned this before, but the True Accent speech recognition tool is a very cool feature if you've gotten a little too used to the surprisingly limited set of sounds we use in English. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience and millions of users for the 25 languages they offer, including Spanish, French, Arabic, Persian, and many others. Their intuitive learning process helps you think and speak with confidence, and it's designed for long-term retention. With both a desktop option and a mobile app, you can take language learning on the go and practice whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Plus, it's an incredible value with a lifetime membership to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. After the Battle of Ankira, both brothers set to work consolidating their kingdoms. But since Antiochus Hyrax is more self-contained within Anatolia, I will focus on him first. One of his first actions after evicting Seleucus was to settle the last of his eastern borders and form an alliance with Zeilus of Bithynia. Despite the Bithynians' recent attack on Hyrax's army, the younger king offered a marriage pact. Hyrax officially committed to marrying Zeilus's daughter as his second wife. With that, all of the notable kingdoms around Hyrax's were allies except for one, Pergamon, the Aeolian city-state on the northwest coast that had successfully revolted for independence from Antiochus I Soter. As it happens, just as war between the Seleucid brothers kicked off, the sitting ruler of Pergamon, Eumenes I, died in or around 241 BCE. He was succeeded by his adopted son and actual nephew, Attalus I. The single most important and famous event in Attalus's reign came early on. And even though it was quite a famous conflict in its time, we don't have a ton of detail to explain how it came to be. A large Galatian army approached Pergamon's borders, and Attalus led his troops out to meet them in battle. The question here is, how and why did a Galatian army get to Pergamon in the early 230s? Sure, Galatian raiders and bandits had been an on-and-off threat across the region for decades, but for the most part, the Anatolian Gauls were based out of Galatia, far to the east of Pergamon, with a significant span of Seleucid territory in between. And Gallic warriors wouldn't have been hurting for work at this particular moment in time. Antiochus Hyrax had just hired all of them. It's possible that these were the Thracian Gauls who crossed over the Hellespont and raided somewhere in Anatolia. But even then, we're talking about a large number, not just a coastal raid. Alternatively, Hyrax had just hired them. Whether the Galatians that attacked Attalus were sent by Antiochus Hyrax intentionally, or were just mercenaries that he hired going rogue and looking for plunder after the Battle of Ankara, who knows? That said, based on what came next, I kind of suspect the former. The Galatian army met the Pergamenes on the banks of the Kaikos River, the modern Barkache in Turkey. Attalus' army beat them soundly, overwhelmingly, driving off the invasion and earning Attalus immense popularity within his own territory. Whether he engineered the popular outcry himself, or the outpouring of support was genuine, Attalus received two new titles for his achievements. First, he was compared to Antiochus I and declared Soter, the savior. And with that, as so many had done before him when receiving semi-divine titles after a victory in battle, Attalus was declared Basileus, the king of Pergamon. Sometimes the Battle of the Kaikos River is framed as part of the Gallic migration into Anatolia, but that doesn't make sense chronologically. Honestly, I think it's mostly just that Attalus commissioned the famous statue of the dying Gaul to commemorate these events, and that is the most common artistic touchstone for ancient Galatia. A lot of authors try to present the conflict that followed as a Galatian war, with Antiochus Hyrax along for the ride. Which, I suppose, it could have been, but a more mutual arrangement is just much more likely. Through this alliance with Hyrax, the Galatians were boxed in. They were suddenly allies with all of their neighbors, but Hyrax was effectively paying them tribute to retain mercenary services. So the Galatians wouldn't want to upset their new alliance and get cut off. However, they still wanted to raid and pillage wealthy Greek cities. And the last holdouts that weren't already paying them tribute and bribes were in Pergamon. Simultaneously, Antiochus wanted royal legitimacy, and could hardly be expected to let this petty tyrant in Pergamon claim titles even grander than his own, while also dominating trade along his coast. So together, the Galatian tribes and Antiochus Hyrax launched a war against Pergamon. It went spectacularly poorly. We don't know much about the war, but an inscription from Attalus in Pergamon did record a list of victories all over Anatolia. Antiochus's alliance seems to have launched the first attack, assaulting a fortress town called Aphrodision just outside the walls of Pergamon itself, only to be repelled. From there, Attalus went on the offensive, and he recorded victories in central Phrygia, Caria, and Coloe, the latter now known as Lake Marmara. In order, Phrygia, especially if he means Hellespontine Phrygia, was the region where Hyrax controlled the largest concentration of coinage mints. And securing those would mean both wealth and legitimacy for Attalus. Going all the way south to Caria was really just showing off, but also served the practical purpose of keeping Antiochus on the move and pressing the advantage. Finally, Coloe was in Lydia, the heart of the imperial political power in Anatolia. So far as we can tell, Sardis itself did not fall at this time, but that would have left Satrap Alexander alone on an urban island in a sea of Pergamene control. After the Battle of Coloe, the would-be king Antiochus Hyrax fled to the east, going all the way to the court of Arsames in Armenia, to seek refuge from the Pergamene onslaught. By the end of the 230s, Attalus and Pergamon effectively controlled all of Seleucid Anatolia.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title, the Great, for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I, would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Seleucus Callinicus's trajectory after the Battle of Ancyra is a bit harder to track because he went east. And as we know, the Imperial East is basically a black hole that consumes all written records never to be seen again. But we can piece together a slight chronology from some of the events referenced in this period and the archaeological materials. The exact chronology just depends a bit on when you place Ancyra. I've seen basically every option from 240 to 237 in modern research, and which end of that spectrum you choose basically determines whether the king went to the Far East and returned to Mesopotamia, or went to Mesopotamia and then continued east. Personally, I'm going with John D. Granger's interpretation, at least loosely, and I am going to accept a later date for Ancyra, because I think diminishing Seleucus' army as much as possible first better explains the rest of the story. One of the only events we can firmly date here is another revolt in Babylon. This time in May or June of 237 BCE, according to an astronomical diary written in the city. That diary briefly references fighting inside the city again, this time right up to the gates of the satrap's palace. Apparently, Seleucus II arrived shortly after the fighting started, or was even already in residence when the revolt broke out, because the diarist referenced the king's personal guard joining the palace garrison to suppress the rebels. Much like the revolts against Antiochus II at the beginning of his reign, this does not seem to have been a widespread rebellion in southern Mesopotamia, but Babylon itself did rebel. We might even wonder if some Ptolemaic supporters were still in the city after its brief occupation a few years earlier. Regardless of cause, some dissatisfied Babylonians saw this moment of imperial chaos as their time to strike, and Seleucus had to intervene and put an end to the rebellion. From there, he turned north and marched into Media to deal with a crisis in the northeast, and of course, this is a crisis I planted the seeds for several episodes ago in 152. The Parni Sakka, under their greatest warlord Arsaces, had grown from a sporadic band of raiders operating across the central steppe of the Caspian Sea to a legitimate threat, and they had conquered the city of Ostowene around 247. When I first covered that event, I inaccurately said he was proclaimed Vasileus, the Greek word for king. That isn't quite right. Arsaces probably was declared king, shah, or at least something close to that word in his own language, but in Greek, at this stage, he used the title autokrator. The autokrator was somewhere between military dictator and elected general. It was used in Hellenistic states to describe a particularly important military leader, and it was the favored title of Andragoras and Diodotus, the pseudo-independent satraps of Parthia and Bactria around this time. Arsaces' use of autokrator as a title was probably just copying the format familiar to him at that time and place. So personally, I favor placing the fall of Ostowene in 247, or year one of the new Arsacid era the new king's subjects would use to date documents after he was fully established, a mimicry of the more popular Seleucid era. However, while I'm going to stick to that in the future, I feel obligated to explain just how little we understand of this time period. I've done my best to present things as a narrative so far, based on the order of events that makes sense to me. That's how roughly half of Arsacid history writers approach things. The other half spend way more time doing what I will do today. Sometime between 260 and 228 BCE, in the reigns of Antiochus II and Seleucus II, the following events happened, in some sort of order. Arsaces invaded Seleucid Margiana, Parthia, and Bactria at different points. The satraps of Parthia and Bactria, Andragoras and Diodotus, became increasingly independent. Andragoras may have preceded, or been accompanied by, two other local governors referenced in this period as well. Diodotus and or the local forces of Margiana successfully repelled the Parni invasion. Arsaces invaded Parthia and took control of Ostoene, renaming it Arshak in his own name. During the Third Syrian War and the Seleucid Civil War, Andragoras and Diodotus stopped participating in Seleucid affairs altogether, effectively placing both of their provinces in revolt as far as Seleucid taxes were concerned. Arsaces proceeded to campaign against Andragoras, in particular for years, eventually conquering the Parthian capital, Hecatompylos, and killing Andragoras. He proceeded to expand his power into Hyrcania to the north and west of Parthia. He also turned east and invaded Bactria. More on that in a minute. At some point in all of this, Seleucid II marched on Parthia at least once. But to me, it seems more likely that there were at least two battles between Seleucus and the Parthians. And therein lies the confusion. From here on out, the Parni, Arsaces' tribe of Saka, are no longer a relevant name. Once they had conquered Parthia, the rest of history would remember Arsaces, his people, and their state as the Parthians. There are good reasons for this that I will explore in future episodes, but just having that context is what's important now. All of our sources for this event were written much later by authors looking back on this as the genesis of a Parthian empire, and their terminology can get quite confusing. We aren't sure whether or not Seleucus first marched against Andragoras, treating him as a rebel, or if he only arrived after Arsaces had conquered the territory. It's equally possible that Andragoras had allied temporarily with Arsaces to fend off the Seleucid royal army, and then those two went back to fighting one another. All we know is this. After their first encounter, Arsaces and his army withdrew into the territory of another Saka tribe outside of the Parthian borders, at least according to Strabo. However, Justin, and the progression of history in general, is firm that Arsaces was ultimately victorious, and all accounts agree that Seleucus ultimately withdrew from Parthia altogether. He was never able to make it to Bactria at all. We don't have a timeline for these events, so we don't understand the context for this clash, or clashes as it may have been. It's entirely possible that the so-called withdrawal was some sort of feigned retreat, a tactic that Parthian armies in later centuries became famous for. Or it may be as simple as just going to an ally to pick up reinforcements. Regardless, the ultimate outcome for Seleucus was decisive. The northeastern satrapies were entirely lost as King Arsaces settled into the throne of a Parthian kingdom. Over in Bactria, Satrap Diodotus died around 235 BCE, and was succeeded by his son, Diodotus II. Most of what we know about Bactria after it slipped from Seleucid control comes from a complex chronology with lots of arguments based on the coinage minted by their rulers. This study of coinage is called numismatics, and I'll cover that another day too. It's just one of those episodes this time. For now, what you need to know is that Diodotus I, despite being remembered as the First, never proclaimed himself king as far as we know. His coinage was initially stamped with his own portrait and the label King Antiochus during the reign of Antiochus Theos. After that king died, or at least around that time, Bactrian coins switched to the label of Diodotus, claiming authority for himself, but not the royal title. After repelling the Arsacid invasion, he added the title Soter, a typical Hellenistic royal choice, but the word Basileus still never appears on the coins. Diodotus II had no such qualms. His coinage was clearly marked of King Diodotus, and with that, the infamous Greco-Bactrian kingdom was fully up and running as an independent state. Diodotus II quickly made an alliance with Arsaces, probably a mutual defense agreement to maintain their shared independence, but we don't know if he contributed troops to the battle with Seleucus II, or just stayed out of it and promised not to attack Parthia himself. Additionally, another Babylonian astronomical diary references another round of riots or combat in the streets of the ancient city amidst all of this Iranian action, possibly around the time Seleucus hit Parthia in 234 BCE. There is some good evidence to suggest that at least one of Seleucus's confrontations with the Parthians came at the end of our vague 238 to 228 time frame, because that's when the war with his brother briefly resumed. Antiochus Hyrax, who had fled to Armenia after losing all of western Anatolia to Attalus and Pergamon, eventually recouped his strength, probably borrowing some money from mercenaries and some soldiers from his allies in the region. Antiochus struck out again. He, or at least one of his allies, briefly took over a mint in Cilicia and put out new coins featuring Hyrax's portrait. But this was short-lived, quashed either by Ptolemy or Attalus, or a combination of both, since they were allies at the time. Antiochus himself marched south from Armenia and launched an invasion of northern Mesopotamia, apparently in a bid to take the Seleucid core around Babylon and Syria while his brother was in Iran. This might have been in response to yet another round of Babylonian riots, referenced by the astronomical diaries in 229. Seleucus did not face down his brother personally this time. Instead, two generals and brothers led the defense of Mesopotamia. These were Achaios and Andromachus, the sons of the royal uncle, also named Andromachus. We know that it was a son and not the uncle himself, primarily because Uncle Andromachus was a prisoner of war in Egypt at this point. They fought a battle in the foothills of the Armenian mountains, right at the northern edge of Assyria, and Antiochus Hyrax was wounded, fleeing into the mountains again with his army, making camp at the foothills. Hyrax intentionally circulated a rumor that he had died and ordered his mercenary generals to negotiate with Andromachus. Andromachus wanted Hyrax's body as proof of the rebel prince's death and to prepare for a state funeral. Hyrax's generals claimed that they couldn't find the corpse, but offered to let Seleucid troops into their camp and prepare to be taken as prisoners. Andromachus agreed to this, sent 4,000 soldiers expecting to be prison guards, who were then ambushed as Hyrax revealed he was still alive. This ambush was not enough to restart the rebellion, but it was enough for Antiochus to make his escape. He and a small band of retainers and loyal soldiers managed to flee east and find passage on a ship bound for Thrace. One of his generals was from Lysimachia, and he may have been headed there, or potentially to the court of Demetrius in Macedon as a royal exile. But on the road in Thrace, they were ambushed by one of the local Gallic bandit tribes, and Antiochus was killed. And that's where I'm going to leave things for now. The Seleucid Empire was well and truly shattered. Anatolia, with the exception of a few individual cities, was gone. Parthia's gone. Bactria's gone. The status of central and southern Iran was up in the air, but that's a story for another day. For all intents and purposes, the Seleucid Empire was now about one-third of Syria, Mesopotamia, and Media. That's all that was left. Make your bets on whether or not they can pull out of this nosedive now. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.